This is Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins, and we're starting off our program now with a look back at what transpired in the state and the city in 2014.
It's a tough job being mayor of Boston, any city. Toughest job in America is to be a mayor.
Tom Menino passed his urban mechanics toolbox to Marty Walsh just months before Menino lost his battle with cancer. Walsh's ambitions are more modest than grand.
I want to be able to say the schools are better. I want to be able to say that there's more opportunities in neighborhoods. I want to talk about the violent crime is a surprise when it happens.
Statewide, Charlie Baker beat out Martha Coakley in one of the tightest elections in years.
Voters responded to our message about sort of that bipartisanship and balance on Beacon Hill.
For 40 days, Market Basket was in chaos during what's been called the strangest labor action in history.
600 people just crippled a $1 billion company.
We'll also look at protests over policing. Joining us now to talk more about these stories and others this year is John Carroll. He's professor of communications at Boston University and the man behind the Campaign Outsider blog and a frequent guest on the program. Hello, John.
Hello, Lisa.
Also with us, David Scharfenberg. He writes about politics for the Boston Globe, and he's a longtime friend of the show as well. Nice to have you here, David.
Thank you.
Okay, first up, the transition from Tom Menino to the new mayor, Marty Walsh. Menino's shoes could not have been bigger, as you guys know, in a city where he was the longest-serving mayor. It was Father John Conley who presided over Mayor Menino's funeral last month.
Mr. Menino, what are you going to do with your life? And the mayor replied, as a high school senior, I'm going to build bridges.
John Carroll, Tom Menino never really stopped being mayor. He appeared at many official functions right alongside Marty Walsh just up until the time of his death. What is lost with Tom Menino's passing, and what's gained with Marty Walsh's ascendancy?
Well, I think what's lost with Tom Menino's passing is a sort of a sense of continuity in the city of Boston. There was a stability that Tom Menino brought to the city that that was comforting to a lot of people. And I think he had a pretty well-oiled machine in a number of different ways.
It was stability not just in name, but also in style, in politics, and
in
values.
He was totally reliable. I mean, reliable almost to a fault in terms of his consistency in governing the city. But the flip side of stability is stagnancy. And there was some of that as well. What Marty Walsh brings is a sort of a fresh set of eyes, a fresh perspective to the mayor's office. And he's done some things. I mean, he brought City Hall kicking and screaming into the 20th century in terms of technology. They finally have voicemail at City Hall, which they didn't have for the vast majority of Tom Menino's tenure there.
Was that because Menino didn't want it? Or
Tom
just
Menino wanted anybody who called City Hall to get a human voice at the other end. So there was no voicemail. So you can imagine sort of the vagaries of something like that. You know, are they there? Are they in a good mood that day? There were a whole lot of sort of technological ways to be in touch with the people of Boston that Tom Menino pretty much avoided, that Marty Walsh has embraced. So he's got video conferencing. He's instituting a 311 emergency line for city services, that kind of thing. Development has boomed under Marty Walsh, and there were particular people who did well under Tom Menino in terms of real estate development. A lot more people seem to be doing well under Marty Walsh, and I think that his relationships with the unions is something that is a big improvement. Tom Menino banged heads with the unions all the time. Marty Walsh got a firefighters union contract that they had been without a contract for 3 years. He just negotiated a deal today to extend the school day for Boston Public Elementary Schools. So I think that is something that has worked to the city's advantage.
I wonder, David Scharfenberg, to what extent you agree with what John was saying there, and also your own thoughts on the legacy of Tom Menino and how Marty Walsh is either carving his own path or embracing Menino's.
I think he is a fresh set of eyes, for sure. I think he appears to be something of the incrementalist, though, that we saw with Tom Menino. I mean, we have not seen a big game-changing proposal yet out of the Walsh administration. That's tough to do as mayor, as opposed to, say, governor or president, of course. But, you know, he has launched a new kind of housing plan he's hoping to float. But I think, you know, the real kind of lesson of the Menino years is the power of longevity, right? I mean, he was the urban mechanic. He was about tweaking, doing this and that. And it was really the body of work over 20 years in office that we saw by the time he had left. And so I think with Marty Walsh, we're going to have to see how long he sticks around. He seems to have that same general kind of style, and we'll see what kind of staying power he has, what sort of patience he has with the job, and whether that translates into something big at the end of his tenure.
And what do you say to what John mentioned about Marty Walsh having closer ties with the unions, able to get more done, seeing more development already under Marty Walsh? Perhaps this is kind of the honeymoon phase or something that you think has traction?
I think he does have real relationships with the unions. I think that's likely to last for some time. He did spend a life in organized labor. That was a real selling point for him on the campaign trail. I mean, he got dinged as someone who would perhaps be too close to unions. He said, look, I will use that closeness to get good deals for the city. Thus far, he can claim a couple of victories on that front. So, the longer he's in office, perhaps that starts to fade a bit. But I think at the moment, at least, he can make a real claim on that front.
Let's move on to what was the closest election for the past half century in Massachusetts. Charlie Baker edging out Martha Coakley. Charlie Baker will take office as governor January 8th. Martha Coakley, who we're going to hear from now after the votes were counted, she said she'd do everything pretty much the same again.
I would not change a single thing. I was so honored to do this race. I've learned so much. I learned a lot about myself and about Massachusetts. I think we did everything we could have done. We left nothing on the table. And look, there's only one winner.
David Scharfenberg, do you think she should have done something different?
I was just talking to a political operative today who was saying, the lesson she seemed to learn from the last campaign was that she needed to kind of work harder, at least appear to be working harder. As we all recall, in her Senate run against Scott Brown, she was seen as someone who would fairly or not kind of taking it for granted. This time she was really out on the campaign trail, shaking hands, et cetera. That made a difference. But we still, I don't think, saw kind of a real passion around the issues. We didn't see her standing for something bold and identifiable, or where she did, not necessarily backing it up with the eloquence of a Deval Patrick or the devotion of a Ted Kennedy. If she'd been able to muster some of that, perhaps she would have been more successful in this liberal state that does favor Democrats for the most part. So she certainly got out there and pressed the flesh, but we may not have seen kind of the passion, the issue stands that we needed out of her.
John Carroll, as the campaign outsider, what do you say? What's your takeaway from the race?
Well, David's right. She certainly worked a lot harder. I don't think she worked much better. Martha Coakley is not a natural-born campaigner. And in fact, she's pretty bad at it. And the thing that she totally liked, as far as I could tell, was the element of surprise. There was nothing that was surprising about Martha Coakley or her positions or her campaigning for the entire time. And I think that you could talk a lot about Charlie Baker and, the rhyme of the Ancient Mariner. That was a real interesting sort of situation with his tall tale of the fisherman story. Even the sweetheart rumpus that he went through, where he called a television reporter sweetheart. He did much better with female voters this time around than he did last time around because he changed. He realized that he had to do something different from 2010. And I think he changed very effectively. I mean, there was a lot of talk about he was no longer the mean Charlie Baker. He was the nice Charlie Baker. But he did a lot of other things, too, that sort of changed the physics of the race. And Martha Coakley didn't. And I think that that essentially anybody who loses and says I wouldn't have done anything different is going to have a hard time winning.
The what about the argument that a Republican like Charlie Baker can keep a deep blue state like Massachusetts honest versus having a Democrat in charge? Or was it that Charlie Baker is a Republican, or just that he's not Martha Coakley?
Well, I think it was a little bit of both. I mean, there's a tradition in Massachusetts, obviously, of having a Republican governor with a Democratic legislature.
Which, for people outside the state, it confounds them.
Yeah, but I mean, inside the state, it makes perfect sense because otherwise you have a runaway train. So Bill Weld, Paul Cellucci, they all campaign on, don't have a gang of three up there, have a gang of two, and then have me as the sort of the balancer. So there was that, certainly. But I think that Charlie Baker offered the voters something something different and something more appealing than Martha Coakley did.
Voters like outsiders. I mean, Deval Patrick was his own kind of outsider, the first governor. Republicans have a natural built-in outsider credential. You know, they are Republicans running in Massachusetts, and I think that's worked pretty well for those who have had success here, and it worked for Charlie Baker.
Yeah, and Baker's been smart. I mean, everybody talks about how he's basically brought together the left and the right in his appointments, and he's been bipartisan. I mean, that's like congratulating him for wearing a suit to work every day. A Republican is going to have to do that if he's going to want to be effective in Massachusetts. So that's no surprise. But I think that he's done a good job of sort of navigating that that process to give people the impression that he is going to be someone who's going to try to work across party lines and try to be effective and bring effective government to Massachusetts, which was one of his big themes when he ran in the race.
I wonder if you could put, well, for both of you, maybe a finer point on that, running an effective government. So let's say we're talking a year from right now, at the end of 2015. What would you like to have seen Charlie Baker as governor accomplished by then, for both of you? David, you first?
Well, I think that's going to be the big question here. He ran as a manager. When Bill Weld won the governorship back in 1990, he was the first Republican after 16 years of Democratic rule. He talked about a new kind of entrepreneurial government. He talked about people being shaken loose from the failed dogmas of big government, et cetera. You know, he promised something big. Whether he delivered is a matter of debate. Charlie Baker was really talking about kind of managing this state of ship a bit better. And what that means in terms of policy, I think, is really the big question of this first year of Charlie Baker's administration.
Yeah, real quickly, I'd like to see things not happen under Charlie Baker, like the compounding pharmacy, like the state drug lab, like the Department of Children and Families, which has been in a shambles up to now. I would like to see those things go away so that we don't have those kinds of really horrific incidents.
All right, let's talk about labor right now and what was called one of the strangest labor actions in U.S. business history. It happened right here. The Demoulas family feud spiraled out of control, got completely twisted in what was a kind of a pseudo-strike that encompassed a lot of things, labor, class, income, inequality. John Carroll, after an almost biblical 40 days and 40 nights, Arthur T. Demoulas emerged victorious, and you can hear it here. He talked to workers in Tewksbury.
The associates of Market Basket, the customers of Market Basket, you and only you have taught the professors and the CEOs that the workplace here at Market Basket is so much more than just a job.
Well, what did the workers teach the CEOs of Market Basket?
Well, first of all, this is like a full employment situation for the people over at Harvard Business School. They're going to be doing case studies on this for years
to come.
Not just
there, but also everywhere across the country.
This was the biggest mismatch since Nixon versus McGovern. I have never seen a group of corporate executives as tin-eared and ham-handed as the Arthur S. forces were, the new CEOs they brought in. I mean, they did everything wrong. And Arthur T. just rode the wave. I mean, he had a group of really remarkable employees who were willing to lose their jobs in order to save the company that they wanted to work for. So I think that it's a remarkable story. I think that the board of Market Basket couldn't have botched it worse than they did. It'll be interesting to see if the Arthur T. Demoulas they brought back can stay the same Arthur T. Demoulas. He's got $1.5 billion worth of debt service. He seems to be doing well so far. They've opened three new stores. If he can keep Market Basket what it was, it'll be a pretty remarkable achievement.
Well, David, you can comment on this. The company just gave out more than $49 million in end-year bonuses to employees. Sales are up right now. There are three more stores opening up this year. Do you think Market Basket can keep it up?
They seem to be in pretty good position, as you just laid out, in terms of what we're seeing thus far. I mean, you know, for me, this is sort of the exception that proves the rule a little bit here. I mean, I'll be curious to see what those professors at Harvard Business School make of this or how they teach it. It doesn't seem to me like something we're going to see replicated all over the place. If not, it's sort of a commentary on how infrequently we see people having such loyalty to their boss, to their workplace these days. You know, this is kind of an era of people staying in jobs for shorter and shorter periods of time, less and less kind of employer loyalty. And this was really kind of the exception that proved the rule in a way.
Okay, before we move on to Hubbub, our weekly segment, I want to just ask you one more question. And this has to do, of course, with race relations. The year has been marked by the ongoing conflict between police and the communities that they serve. This starting with the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and the decision not to indict the white police officer who shot him. There was the choking death of Eric Garner in New York, and then two police officers were killed in New York this month. All of that seems to have pushed the debate in a new direction. Here's what Mayor Marty Walsh told a community meeting last month, that Boston is different from other cities, but it still faces problems.
You know, I'm not going to pretend that everything's okay here in the city of Boston, or that the legacy of injustice can be fixed overnight. Because we know it can't be. We need to do more for outreach into neighborhoods. We need to do more to build trust with our young people in the city of Boston. They shouldn't view the police as enemies. They should view the police as partners.
John, there's an awful lot to unpack there. The summer's questions about the militarization of police before that stop and frisk tactics, the prudence of public officials criticizing the police this month. Do you see anything changing about the way police go about their jobs?
Well, I certainly think that the police did everything they could to handle this with as much soft power as possible in terms of the protests that we had in Boston. I don't think it was quite the pajama party that they depicted it, but it was a pretty much a minimum of clashing between the police and the protesters. There were arrests, and some people claim they got roughed up. But compared to other cities, it's been relatively calm and relatively peaceful here in terms of the protests. I think there are some sort of underlying situations that are more complicated than what we've seen on the surface. There's a lot of diversity here in terms of the protesters, but there's also a certain uneasiness among the sort of diverse forces in terms of who should be taking the lead.
How do you mean that?
I've heard people in the black community who said, you know, it's great that we have support from the white community, but we don't want them to be the voice of this. So that's one sentiment that we've heard. There is a push on Beacon Hill to draft a bill that would define and ban racial profiling by police. So far, the police have not been involved in the consideration of that. Their perspective hasn't been brought in. So there are some disconnections that are happening in Boston that seem to be below the surface. Marty Walsh and Deval Patrick have openly questioned the protests and said that you would normally think that they would be on board. They've openly questioned them and said, "What do you want? What are you doing here? Holding up traffic, causing you know a certain amount of disruption." So I think this is not as smooth and sort of coordinated as it sometimes appears.
David, I wonder what you think about that.
I was actually working at the State House in our State House bureau the night of these protests, and it was pretty thunderous, the sound outside, and I could kind of look down through our window and see folks making their way up through the common. And I think, you know, as was just alluded to, the question is going to be, you know, how much do those folks actually get into places like the State House? How much are they able to shift policy? There seems on the one hand to be an openness to change here and an assertion that we're in pretty good shape and we don't need much change. I was speaking with the departing governor when I was working on a piece on his judicial legacy. He was saying his great regret is that he was not able to win the elimination of mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent crimes. He viewed that as a big kind of unfinished piece of his legacy. But, you know, district attorneys are opposed to that. They say we need these mandatory minimums in place to really have kind of uniform enforcement of the law. So there are real objections to some of these changes, and I think it's we just don't know at this point if it's going to mean real change or not.
I wonder, in terms of the regulatory or legal front, and in terms of just kind of the street front, is this all finished? John, it sounds like you're saying there's a lot that's unresolved here in Boston.
I think there is a lot that's unresolved here, and I think that these things are going to start to crystallize as we go forward, because if there's not some kind of action that people can point to that will change the dynamic, I mean, Mayor Walsh says he wants there to be better relations. What exactly is going to happen to bring that about? And if people don't see some kind of specific movement forward in terms of these rifts and these divides, I think that it's going to rekindle the protests in maybe a more volatile form.
All right. We have just enough time right now to talk about our hubbubs of the year in this case, those little stories that caught your eye, David and John, and maybe did not make it to the front page. David Scharfenberg, what's yours this week?
Well, I've got one actually out of Quincy. This was back in the fall, in March. The Patriot Ledger down there, the newspaper, reported that the Quincy Public Works Department had burned reams and reams of public records without getting kind of the proper approval for it. And this seems to be an issue that's kind of bubbling up here locally and in the state and across the country. I mean, we had a story in the Globe recently about the Secretary of State's office, ordering agencies to release more in the way of public records, only some 20% of the time when folks requested public records and they were initially denied by these agencies. There's been, of course, a lot of hand-wringing about the Obama administration and its pledges of unparalleled transparency that haven't quite come to be. And I think this local story really hit at an issue that's important, particularly for us in the press.
And do we know what kind of records they were?
They claim that they were, they were payroll records, records of various kind of payments and fees and such. They claim that they weren't terribly important, but of course, we'll never know what kind of what kind of information might have been pulled from them.
All right, John Carroll, your hubbub of 2014.
My hubbub comes from the New York Times a couple of weeks ago in a piece headlined "What People Buy Where," and it looked at, it compared the different regions of the country and different cities in the country what they spend their money on, particular goods and services, to symbolize status. So in Boston, the status symbol of choice is tuition to a private school. Other fun facts to know and tell: Boston spends 40% more than the national average for newspapers and magazines.
Spend more, or it's just charge more here?
No, they spend more.
They spend more.
It might surprise some, but not many, that Bostonians spend 25% less than the national average on cosmetics. they also spend more on coffee and books. So obviously being smart is important in Boston. My question is, if Bostonians are so smart, why did they pay 330% more alimony than the national average here in Boston? I'm not really sure how that works, but it's a big chunk of money.
Well, you can say that we just keep them guessing.
Well, maybe we're just too smart for our own good.
Too smart for our own good. That's John Carroll, professor at Boston University and author of the Campaign Outsider blog. David Scharfenberg is a reporter at the Boston Globe. Nice to speak with you both. We hope to see you again very often in the new year. Thank you both.
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
And stay with us. Speaking of coffee, we're going to be talking about the drug that millions of us depend on every day, caffeine. I'm Lisa Mullins, and this is Radio Boston.